Good afternoon, everybody. So today we're going to look a little bit more at the code generation. Last week we started looking at the virtual machine and how a stack-based virtual machine works. And then we proceeded to like ask, well, what happens if you only have a register machine? Well, or if you also have registers, then the code that you want to generate might be slightly different because you need to use the registers rather than the stack. But on the other hand, the registers were used by a... we had this code generation function code I, and the I was basically an index that we could use. And the I would say which registers were still available, and the set of available registers or the set of used registers is basically also kind of organized as a stack. The higher, so an I of 5 means that all the registers R0 to R4 are currently used, and so the higher I becomes, the more registers we are using. Okay, so we saw various code generation schemes. So for instance, for if statements, we would, so we had an address environment and we had the two code generation functions, code I and code RI. Can anybody tell me what the difference were between the two? What was the R? What was the code generation function with the R? So we had code RI and we had code I. Which one is used where?
R was the right-hand side and R was for the statements.
Yes, so this is for right-hand sides and this is for statements. So right-hand sides means the right-hand side of an expression. So we would use code R on the expression x equals x minus y. And this is also a statement, and we have this C-specific rule that if you wanted to generate code for a statement S that is also an expression, then code I is equal to code R of I. Sorry, this should be a superscript. Okay, so if we look at the code here, the code generation, well, always has this address environment here that I've sloppily omitted. So if we generate code for this if statement, we will first generate the code for the conditional, and that conditional says x if x is greater than y. So generating the code for x will generate this move statement, because in the address environment we know that x is at located in register 4. And so code R of x for the register I generates the result of x in RI, and this is what the move statement does. And then in I plus 1, we generate the value of y, which generates the move statement that we move the value content from R7, which holds y, into RI plus 1. And then we use these two registers in a greater than test, which takes RI and RI plus 1. And if this condition holds, then RI, the target register, is set to 1, otherwise it's set to 0. So if this test is false, RI is 0. And then for the if statement, we've generated a jump statement that jumps beyond the then branch. So this is the then branch, which in this case resides at the A label. So we jump to A if RI is true. And this here is the code for the then branch. So we look at that. And the code for the assignment is a move of the result RI that moves this result to R4. And the right-hand side, the code is the code that we saw for R4, and we generate the result in RI. Sorry, for X, so this is X, and this is Y, and then we have a subtract statement, and the result is an RI, that's what we write to to X, and then this jump statement is from the if statement. It's part of the translation scheme for the if statement. And very analogously, the else branch here, the things are just X and Y are swapped around when we store the result in Y. And then the label B is the position just after this, the if statement, and the code generated for the if statement for the after the execution. The once the then branch is finished, the direct jump is going to B, so that we jump over the else statement. Okay, so this is what we've done. We've done this if statement last time with these one or two then or else branches, so sometimes the else branch is missing. So there's also the while statement, which is very similar, so generating code for the while statement has to generate code for the condition E, and the statement, the body of the while statement is represented by an instruction sequence. So we generate the code for the expression into register RI, and then we jump over the whole over the rest of the while statement if this condition is false, because then the while loop terminates. And the body of the while loop is the code generated for the statement sequence, so there's no R here, it could be other while loops or if statements. And once we're at the end of the while loop, we do a jump to A, and A is the label where the condition starts. So once we've executed the body of this of the while loop, we jump back to where the condition is re-evaluated. And in case the condition is evaluated to false, then we jump out of the loop. And the whole thing can be represented by this diagram as well, where we jump over the whole while statement when the condition is false, and at the end we always jump back to test the condition again. Okay. So what is the code that I would have to write down here? So now we have this in address environment, and I want to generate the code. Just code, because it's a statement. Code I of this thing in the address environment row. What is the first thing of the while loop that we translate?
The test of A is greater than zero.
Yeah. So assuming that it's at I, we load the value of A into register RI, which is which statement? I heard something. Move. So we move into RI the value of which register? R7, because that's where X is located. Then we need to load the register RI plus 1 with a constant. Does anybody remember? Load C0. Then we do a test. Greater R. The target will be R1, and the two arguments R1 and RI and RI plus 1. Okay, now we in RI we have 0 if the test doesn't hold and 1 if it holds, and the only conditional jump we have is jump 0, which we will use now. Jump 0 if RI is 0. And where do we jump to? I think I heard B. So I'll just say B, doesn't matter. Where do I put B? Let's put it here. What do I write before B? The body. What's the body? Okay, so we can still reuse the register RI, so we generate code for the register RI. And which register do we moving? Are we moving from? R9. Then we
load CD1 in RI plus 1.
Load CRI plus 1, 1, and then we do an add into RI. with Ri and Ri plus 1. And then we store this whole thing in C, which is
R9.
R9. So we say move R9 Ri. Okay, and very similar for the A is equal to A minus B. Okay. There it is. Yeah, I think that's pretty much what we've just written. Oh yeah, and at the very end we have the jump A statement at the end of the body of the while, which is from the translation scheme for while. Okay, so I think this doesn't pose too many problems. Seems that you're all okay with that. So then there's also for loops. So we'll just look at this briefly. So the for loop is basically a while loop in disguise. The for loop is identical to first executing E1 and then taking E2 as the condition, and E3 we put after the statement sequence of the while, or after the body of the while loop. And then basically what comes out is exactly the coding scheme we put this in and we reuse the code generation scheme for a while and we get out this scheme for four. So this is not very exciting. Okay, I'd like to then say something about more interesting statements. So the only statement where you actually have a few choices how to implement it is the switch statement. And the switch statement should be reasonably fast because it is not an if statement. If the program only had an if statement, the program would start writing big cascades of if nested if statements. And the switch statement is supposed to avoid that and to give the programmer something that is actually faster. So I'm just looking at a translation of very specific switch statements, namely those that lend themselves to an efficient translation. So what we want to have is some statement where we can have some sort of constant time branching on some condition when we have several options. And the idea is to use a jump table for that. That is a table with labels, once the labels are resolved, with basically code addresses into the that contain possible program counters where the execution continues if that specific case in the switch statement is chosen. So if we, for instance, we say switch x and then we say case 1 colon until case k, for instance. So, and we can say ensure that x is between 1 and k, then we can, let's make this a 0, it's much easier. And this table here resides at b, then we can just jump to b plus x. We will jump to b plus x, but that requires that there's not only a in there, but an instruction saying jump to A. So this is jump A1 to jump AN. So this instruction we haven't seen yet because all the jump instructions we had was the unconditional jump that just jumps to a label and the conditional jump 0 that jumps if a specific register is 0. But this here requires a so-called computed jump or an indirect jump. And so this is the instruction for that. It's called jump I for indirect. And what it does, it takes a label A and it adds the contents of the register RI to this label, giving a new address where we're jumping to. So if this jump I instruction was at the at program counter B, then afterwards the program counter will be set to A plus Q, where Q is the content of the register RI. Okay? Okay, so now let's make some assumptions on the switch statement so that our translation scheme is actually easy to describe. So this is the general layout, I'm assuming, that we have various labels. These are all numbers. And for these numbers, I require that the next number is just that a certain number plus one is equal to the next number, meaning that all these labels should be C0 to CK minus one. They should all be consecutive. No holes. I don't say that they have to start at zero. I'm just saying they're all consecutive. And that will make our lives easier in translating this switch statement as a jump table or as a constant table. So this is the general layout. So this whole case statement I'm calling S. So it's a whole switch statement S. And I'm translating this as a statement into the register, starting with register RI, as follows. I generate the code for the expression. Then the result of this expression will be in RI. And then I have a macro here that I'll describe on the next page. And this macro takes two constants, C0 and CK minus 1, which gives me the lower and the upper bound of possible values. And I'm also giving it the location of the jump table. Now, the jump table is here, contains the following jumps. It contains instructions jump A0 up to the instruction jump to AK minus 1. And these are just labels. And the labels are over here. And at A0, I generate the code for the statements at the first case label. And so on, at the label AK minus 1, I'm generating the code for the statements in the kth case statement. And at the end of each of these instruction sequences within each case, I'm jumping to D, and D is here. I've decided it's here. And what's missing here is the default. Oh, let's call this SD. And here at C, I'm generating the code for SD for the default case. And the jump goes after the default code. Okay, so I will now have a look at what the check macro does. So intuitively, the check macro should check that the RI register is between C0 and CK minus 1. And if it is, I can use this table to jump, to do a jump directly to the code block that implements that particular case statement. And if the value of the register is outside this range, then we need to jump to just after the case, after the jump table to execute the default case. So let's see how this works. Okay, here I say that again, it just checks that the value in RI is within the range and then jumps accordingly, which is as follows. Okay, so as I said, this range we need to check, and for convenience, let's just say K is U minus L, so K is the number of cases we have. So the idea is that if we are in this range, if RI is within this range, then we jump to B plus RI minus L. So L is the lower bound. If we subtract that, we will jump to B plus 0 up to B plus K minus 1. And this corresponds directly to these indices. Okay, and then there's the kind of error case. So either my RI might be strictly smaller than L, or it might be greater equal to the upper bound U, and in this case we're jumping to C. And C is the label that just follows the jump table. And by placing the code of the default branch in here, I'm making sure that whenever I'm out of bounds, I'm just jumping to the default case. So this is the macro. So what do I do? I check this and I check this condition. So first I'm checking whether my my RI is or and I ensure that my RI is greater or equal to my lower bound. So I'm loading the constant, the lower bound, into RI plus 1, and I'm then checking whether RI is greater, so the my register is greater than this lower bound, greater equal. If it is greater equal, I'm continuing, otherwise I'm jumping to E as an error. I'll come to that in a second. Okay, so what happens if my RI is greater or equal to L? Well, then I subtract L. So at this point, I know that RI is in the range from 0 to something. And hopefully it's from 0 to K. So now I'm loading the constant K, and I'm checking whether RI is greater than or equal to K. And if it is, then I'm jumping to I've swapped these things around, didn't I? I'm loading K, and I'm checking whether this value is greater or equal to K. If that is the case, I'm continuing. Yeah. So if RI is greater equal to K, which means I'm out of bounds, I'm continuing here at E. And what I do at E is the error path. I'm just loading the constant K into RI, and RI is the value that I'm jumping to. So I'm checking, is RI between 0 and K minus 1? If it is not, set RI to K. So just to the entry right about behind the jump table. So this is address B plus 0, this is address B plus K minus 1, and this is address B plus K, the error condition, which is equal to C. And then I'm doing this indirect jump. I'm just adding the RI to the label B, and I'm getting exactly these indices and B plus K in the default case. Here?
No, after check, parameters of check don't contain K.
I'm not sure where you are.
At the definition of check.
Here?
Yes.
Okay, where?
And there is no K.
Oh, because I have L and U, and I'm just saying, up front, if I have this pattern, if I have L and U, just like locally defined K, while I'm every time, everywhere where I have K, you can just like put in U minus L. Okay, so it's kind of a local let K equal to U minus L in, and then do this. So I could have just like passed L and K, for instance, but somewhere I have to like compute this difference. Okay, are there other questions? Okay. Yeah, so this is talking about the default case again. So whenever I'm erroneous, I'm just saying I set my offset into the jump table to just after the jump table, which gives me the default case. Okay, so as I said, this translation for the switch statement is not a universal one. It just works for case switch statements where the values that you're checking are consecutive. And it can be even more simplified if, for instance, the smallest constant is 0 and not some arbitrary lower bound u. Then we don't need to subtract it. And also, if there's some sort of other, like you could envisage a static analysis that checks whether the code before that already checks that the value is within a certain range. And if so, we might be able to just omit the bounds check. Okay, and then there's this question. Well, this is more like a discussion question. So can we implement the switch statement using an L-attributed grammar without using symbolic labels? So can we just emit the code with all addresses resolved using a single traversal of the abstract syntax tree in a L attributed fashions from left to right. Where are the problems when we just don't want to generate symbolic labels but directly want to generate addresses? Yeah, so somewhere at the jump instruction we will have a problem because we the switch table. So where's the switch table? So first we do the check macro, and then we generate code for the individual cases, and then we have the jump table with a different jump A0, jump A1, and so on. And the problem now is that the check macro needs to know where this jump table is at the very beginning, but we don't know that unless we have generated code for all the statements in the case branches. Yeah. So it's a bit difficult, and using symbolic labels is easier, but you can also do it when you just emit code into basic blocks, and then later on emit the basic blocks when you can determine how big each basic block is. At the end of the day, it's the same thing as symbolic labels, but you might then rearrange the basic blocks as well so that the switch, the jump table could be anywhere. It doesn't have to be behind the case statement. Okay. So in general, this translation doesn't work because the constants in the cases, they might just not be consecutive. So, for instance, if these constants are very far apart, what we could do is we could generate an if ladder that is a sequence of nested if statements. Well, actually, ladder is just like a sequence of if statements. You check whether your expression, you evaluate your expression into Ri, you check whether Ri is equal to the first constant. If so, you execute that statement block. Otherwise, you check the next case statement. So you have lots of if statements, one after the other, which is very expensive. If your code repeatedly uses the switch statement and always chooses the last case or the default case. And what you could also do is an if cascade. So it's a tree of conditionals. So you say if you can do binary search. You can look at your set of constants that define your switch table, and then you just partition these sets of constants into two sets. One, and you look at the middle value, and then you partition it, and then you have an if statement within if statements. So you check whether your expression ri is smaller to the middle value, and then you check the left set and the right set, and so you have this tree of if statements. And in this case, on average, you need log n tests. So that's an option. But also, if you have a set of constants, and the set of constants is not quite so consecutive but has small gaps, three entries, then if you just imagine how big the jump table is, how much bigger the jump table is in comparison to a new if statement which does a comparison and uses a register and does a jump, then it might be sensible to just fill in the empty slots in the jump table with jumps to the default case, because that is usually for three jumps it's shorter than the if statement. And then you could have any hybrid translation scheme where you have a cascade of if statements, and then for each consecutive region you have a jump table. And then if you're really adventurous, you could do profiling on your program, check how many times does the program execute enter this case, how many times does it enter the other cases, and then you could rearrange your if cascade so that the branch that is taken most often is further up in the tree. So there's all sorts of ways to translate switch statements. And I think there will be an exercise about that, because we've done that in the previous exams, and last year we had an exercise about switch statement. So I gave a not quite non-standard semantics to the switch statement in C, and you were supposed to generate the code generation scheme for that.
How many actually passed the exercise?
I think quite a few people passed that exercise. I mean, I don't know. I didn't have the impression that this code generation scheme is very difficult to understand.
No, the code generation.
That's exactly what we're asking in the exam. We say, assume that the case statement behaves like this and that. Write down the code generation scheme. And in the year before, we should make the previous exams available. In the year before, we asked to change the code generation scheme for the for statement, that you could have a continue statement, which basically, if you say continue, you just jump to the beginning of the, or you just do the next iteration, and you have to be a bit creative and generate, like, say how would you modify the translation scheme. Okay. Well, since we're at it, shall I say that? Well, there is, with the bonus, there were some confusions. We expect you, in order to get your bonus for the exam, that you hand in your exercises and that you hand them in individually and not some model solution that you found somewhere or from your neighbor. So please do that individually, not in groups. And if you think you don't want the bonus but you still want to hand in the stuff, then just say if you've copied it or if you work together, then we don't bother with a bonus, but we'll still correct it. So we just want to know. Okay. Back to code generation. How do we translate things to basic blocks? So I said, I always wrote down code generation schemes with labels, and that's certainly the easiest thing to write on code generation schemes. And in the actual implementation, you could try to do it better with basic blocks, so you don't have to go through the tree twice, but you generate a graph immediately, a control flow graph, and then later, in a second stage, you go through the control flow graph and then emit the basic blocks. And since then you know the size, you can rearrange them and you can emit directly basic blocks with fixed addresses. So how could we then implement a translation scheme by a traversal that uses basic blocks? So what we need is when we start translating a function, we need something where we can add statements. So we just create an empty basic block and we pass the translation function a pointer to this empty basic block. And then each time we have a statement, we translate a statement, we just add it to the current basic block at the end. And that way we just fill up the basic block. Yeah, so each new statement that we encounter, we add to the end of the basic block where we have the pointer to. Now, if we have an if statement with both a then and an else branch, we create two new basic blocks because each each statement sequence of the then branch and the statement sequence of the else branch, they will both live in different basic blocks. So we create new, fresh, empty basic blocks, and we pass this pointer to the code generation function that does the then branch, so the statement sequence of the then branch, and we pass the other empty basic block to the code generation function that does the statements of the else branch. And then once they're done, we have the pointers for two basic blocks, and then we we want to create this graph. We have this input basic block here and these two fresh basic blocks, and then we add the edges with the jump zero node and the reverse condition, and then we create another basic block for the statements that come after the if statement, and we make these two basic blocks point to the new one, and then we just give this handle to the new one further to the next statement, code generation for the next statement after the if statement. And so in this way we can just create this control flow graph on the fly using a data structure on the heap. So similar for other constructs for a while, you can do the same trick, just create a new empty basic block and translate the body of the while loop, and then afterwards add the edges. It might be better, like for in case you envisage to do some sort of like analyses, it sometimes it's necessary to go backwards through the control flow. In this case, it might be good to have backwards edges between the basic blocks. So for each basic block, you would have a set of basic blocks then that can jump to this basic block. Okay, any questions about while for basic blocks? I mean, it's rather short. Otherwise, we just turn to functions. So just to give you a preview, we'll now deal with functions, and then we'll have a little bit of nastiness with pointers, and that there the code generation becomes tricky. And for functions, it's more, well, let's say, interesting, illuminating about how programming languages actually work. If you heard virtual machines, that this is probably not necessarily new, but the register aspect is certainly not something that you've done in virtual machines. Okay, so the functions allow you to do a some algorithm, something that you want to do on the memory as repeatedly, by calling it repeatedly. And functions take arguments and they return values, and we need to reflect that somewhere with the registers. So a function has several parts. So first it has a name, and this name eventually winds up to be just an address in the code segment. So that's not so hard. And it also has formal parameters. So the formal parameters are the parameters that you declare at the head of the function, and the actual parameters are the values that you pass at the call side. So it's important to know this difference between formal and actual parameter. A function may or may not declare a result type. And then basically the rest of the function is just a sequence of statements. So in C, if we see a function, so we have a name and it's actually a declared function, what do we do? And like, so this is an expression, so I don't know, we have x is equals to f, and we then call code R on the f. What we do is we load the address constant of f, which I say is underscore f, RI, that's missing here. So we load the address of that function into RI. Which means that every function name must have an address assigned to it. So this makes it difficult to just compile a program without knowing how big the previous function was. And of course we've seen that in C you can declare functions as a forward declaration, and then you can define mutually recursive functions. And so by declaring a function, by having a forward declaration of a function, the compiler knows that it has to assign this one symbolic label to the function that it uses during the translation. Okay, so now the nice thing in functions is that they kind of have a built-in memory management, which is what makes them very convenient. And this memory management is very simple because it's stack-based, so it's very fast as well. So, for instance, if we reconsider this, the faculty function. So this is the faculty function written in Haskell. I think this is valid Haskell. It's not valid Haskell. It's valid C. Oh dear. Sorry, this is the main function, this is the faculty function in C. So the main function just calls faculty twice, once with 2 and once with 1. And what this should illustrate is that a function can be active several times at some point in the program. So for instance, if faculty 2 is called, this function will enter in here, and since x is not less than 2, it's greater, it will call itself recursively with 1. And so afterwards, this function hasn't finished yet, but it calls itself again, so it's recursive. So at runtime, several instances of the same function can be active, which means that an instance is alive of a function, so it is calling something from within that calls the function itself, and it hasn't returned while it does that. So here we call it faculty, and it hasn't hasn't returned before faculty is called. And then we can write a so-called static call graph. This is a mixture of static and dynamic call graph. This is really the dynamic call graph and gathered up, kind of like accumulated. So here main calls faculty, and faculty calls faculty once, and this faculty calls itself again. And then later on, main will call faculty of one, and this will call faculty, and then in this case, faculty will call itself once only, and then return, this returns. And afterwards, we're calling printf. So the dynamic call graph would just show you parts of this, namely a part that can be active at some point in time. So this would, like without the red part, this would be the dynamic call graph if execution reaches the third reaches return one in this call here. Okay, and the static call graph looks like this. It would just say print. It would just normally you just summarize all the calls in one function, so you just say main calls faculty, and faculty calls itself. So this would be the static call graph, which is a call graph that basically is a possibly cyclic graph that goes between functions that tell which function can call which other function. Okay, so the nice thing about functions is that they use a piece of stack for the current instance, and they can use another piece of stack for another instance, and cleaning up the memory is automatic. Okay, so I said formal parameters were the parameters that you declare inside the function declaration, and the actual and these parameters act kind of like local variables that you declare inside the function. And the way we implement this in the register machine is that we have these local and global registers. So other possibilities are, like, if you only have a stack, then you could say, you could look at the formal signature and say, okay, there's like five arguments, so we say the first five elements in the stack when we call the function should contain the function arguments, and after that I will use these stack spaces for the local variables. Yeah, and this piece of memory, well, can be allocated on the stack and could be allocated on the global memory, but that's only done in functional languages where the stack whenever something can survive the function call. So kind of like one could say that each function has its own region on the stack, but of course they're shared, like they're reused. Once a function returns, another function will use that region. And this region on the stack that is just used by a function currently is called the stack frame, and there can be several stack frames for one function. So the idea for just a stack-based implementation is as follows. So assuming that the stack grows upwards, we use the stack pointer to point at the last used cell, and then we have then we have here an area to store local variables and temporary results. So if we need more stack space, we just like push things onto the stack, and the stack pointer increases, and then when we're done with them, we decrease the stack pointer. The function parameters, I'll say something in a second. That depends on the organization. And then the stack frame starts with so-called organizational cells. And one of them is the return address, which here is called PCO, the old program counter that was correct when the function was called. And then we also have a frame pointer, an old frame pointer, and an old extreme pointer, and I'll come to those in a second. The frame pointer is shown here. The frame pointer basically points to these organizational cells. So the trouble is that whenever we need to return, we need to know where to jump to. And so we need to clean up the stack. And we can do that by discarding anything that is above the frame pointer. And this discarding is simply setting SP differently to FP, namely. Okay, so the FP, the frame pointer, it points to the last organizational cell, and it is needed to like recover the old stack frame. So the stack frame, or like the previously active stack frame. So this is the previously active stack frame. It looks exactly like this one, except that it's the stack frame from the caller, and it also will have these organizational cells down here. Yeah, and the extreme pointer has to do with the heap. I will do that one once we do pointers. Okay, so some more technology or terminology. So if f is the current function and this function f calls a function g, then f is called the caller and g is called the callee. So this is important to see and understand this difference. And the code for generating these stack frames and deconstructing these stack frames is split between the caller and the callee. And this is also dependent on how you want to split the memory management between the caller and the callee. But in general, we cannot just like push all this functionality into the, say, caller or just the callee, because there's some things that only the caller knows and only the callee knows. Specifically, only the in C, if you think of the printf function, it says it has an arbitrary number of, it takes an arbitrary number of arguments. So it's only the caller that knows exactly the number of arguments of a specific function. And then on the other hand, it's only the callee that knows how many automatic variables or local variables the user has declared. Oh yeah, okay, so here it is. Space requirement for parameters is only known by the caller. Example is printf, because you can give printf an arbitrary number of arguments. Okay, so this is the schematic of generating code for function calls and for returning in a function. So I'm still assuming that f is calling g, and I'm kind of now mixing operations that appear in F and that appear in G. Okay, so this is basically here the changeover from F to G, from the caller to the callee, and this is the changeover. Oh, here it is, between the callee and the caller. So what do we do if F wants to call G? Then it first of all, it has to compute the address of G. Because in C, it doesn't have to be a constant symbol. It could just be something you store in a structure or whatever. So it could be a general expression. So you compute this general expression and with the intent to calling this address that you're computing. And you know from the declaration what kind of function it is. And this declaration tells you how many arguments there are, for instance. What you then do is you take this declaration and compute all these arguments that the function expects. Then you save these arguments either in registers or on the stack, depending on what your machine specification says. And then there's a couple of registers that you use and that you need to use and be correct after the function returns. And these are called caller safe registers. So we have to save these registers somewhere, and we normally save them on the stack because the stack can grow very cheaply. Then we have a special instruction for that. We come to that in a second. Then we back up this frame pointer and the extreme pointer. These are pointers that we need to return ourselves to our caller. So these are needed in F later. Then we set up the new frame pointer. So we create the initial stack frame for G with the organizational cells, and we let FP point to these organizational cells. And we back up the old PC to these organizational cells, as in our current PC where we want the G to return to. And then we jump to the beginning of G. And this is these three operations, they're all done by the instruction call. Now we are in G, and we before we like run the local statements, we need to make sure that all our local variables are have enough space. So this could either be registers, but they could require stack space. So there's also the adjustment of the extreme point, which has to do with the heap. But we need to, in any case, allocate space for the local variables, which might just mean adjusting the stack pointer by a little bit. Okay, now we have space for local variables. We have the organizational cell, so we have the stack frame. We can do all sorts of local computations in G. And once we're done in G, we want to return. And we want to give a return value to our caller in general. So what we do is we compute the result that we want to return. Then we restore this information in the organizational cells, the old FP that we stored up here in the EP, and the stack pointer that was valid before we created our local variables. And this is done by return, by the return assembler instruction, not the C instruction. What return also does, it looks at this value that was stored in the old stack pointer, or sorry, the old PC, and then it stores this old value in the PC, and thereby the execution continues at F, where it left off, where the execution left off in F. And then once we're back in F, there's still this thing that we have saved all our registers that were active onto the stack. So now we have to restore these registers. So we have to restore the caller saved registers. And then potentially, since we have pushed some parameters, let's say we have pushed k parameters, each parameter used a stack location, we need to like clear these parameters up. So we need to pop parameters off the stack, and this is pop k. Okay, so this is the general scheme from transferring between caller and callee. And now, how do we translate this to our register machine? So on the stack machine, it's clear everything goes onto the stack, and everything has to be communicated via the stack. And the local variables that we have, if we have any, we need to like. If we had any registers, we could save them on the stack. But this is normally not even necessary on the stack machine because you don't have registers; you just have stack locations. Okay, but now we have registers, and we not only want to use registers for local computations, which means we need to save them before we call somebody else. We also want to pass parameters in registers, and this is where the split between global and local registers comes in. So initially I said we have local and global registers. So the local registers were all those registers with positive numbers, and the global registers were the registers with index 0 and minus 1, minus 2, minus 3, and other negative numbers. So now we need both. So the automatic variables, so that is the locally declared variables in a function, they live in local registers. And these are RI, where I is greater, strictly greater than 0. And also any intermediate results and temporary computations that we do, they also live in local registers. And this is these register accesses are all generated by our code I functions. And then parameters are stored in global registers where the I is negative. And it's done as follows. Oh yeah, so R0 is the return value and R-1 is the first parameter, R-2 is the second parameter, and so on. And global variables we could store also in the global registers, but we don't do that for now. I'll just assume there are no global registers. Okay, so yeah, the ith register is stored in R-1, I should say, really. Minus I. And the result is stored in R0, which makes it easy. And then the local registers that we're using for temporary results and local variables, we have to save before calling a function. And now, which registers should we save and which registers should we not save? We do actually have a choice there. So if F calls G, then the register RI is called caller saved if F needs to back up RI, and G can then override it because it can assume it's not used. And the other variant is that a register F is callee saved, which means that the function that's calling is not saving it, but the function that is called, the callee, must save it if it wants to use it. So there's these two options. Either the caller saves the register, then it's caller saved, and the callee may freely override it, or the caller doesn't assume that the callee doesn't change the register, so the caller does nothing, and the callee needs to back up the register if the callee wants to use the register. So these two options we could in principle have for every register that we wanted to, could choose it differently. So in this case, like, what we do is like something simple. We say that that all registers are caller saved, so that the caller saves all the registers and that the callee is free to use any register it likes. Okay, so how do we translate a function call then? So this now follows the schematic that I've shown earlier, where F calls G and G does something, then G does something at the end of the function, then returns to F. So now basically the call is just saying what the F part is before and after the call. So when I generate code for a function call, for instance in F, and this function call is G of E1 to EN, I will first compute the value of G, so the address, and store the result in RI, and then I will compute the first expression, the value of the first argument in RI plus 1 and up until RI plus N. And now I will move these values to the argument registers R minus 1 up to R minus N. And these are, as I said, these are the global registers. They're special. They're only used for passing parameters. Okay, now once I'm at this point, I've created all the arguments. Now I need to save all the local registers that I've used and that I need to be able to access after the call returns. In this case, it is register R1 up to RI minus 1. So I'm okay if the function address, the address of G, the register RI, is overwritten. And I'm okay if these temporary registers are overwritten. So I only need to save R1 to RI minus 1. Then I say mark. So this create the organizational cells. Organizational cells. And then I say call. This will fill in the old program counter onto the stack, push the... So, yeah, one says we push the old PC on the stack. Basically, what we're pushing on the stack is this location, B, here, because we want the function G to return to B once it's done. So we push the address B onto the stack, which is easy enough because we know that call lives at offset B, at address B minus 1. So we just simply look at the current PC, add 1, and push that value onto the stack. Okay, so once the function G that we call returns to F, we restore all the local registers with a special restore location, and then the return value will be in R0. And since we're generating the code so that the value will be in RI, we just move the value in R0, the return value, to RI, and we're done. So this is the code for calling. There is a... Yeah, so this summarizes the new instructions we need. It's safe lock that pushes RI to up to RJ inclusive onto the stack, and the corresponding one to restore the values is restore log ri to rj, and note rj is the last one here, rj is the first one here, so obviously you need to push them into one sequence and you have to pop them off in the opposite sequence, otherwise they'll wind up turned around their values. Okay, so Mark backs up the organizational cells, which means it stores it creates the EP, the frame pointer, and the stack pointer. We'll come to that. And call actually does the function call and stores the old PC. Okay, so there was a trick question here somewhere. I don't know whether it's here. Oh yeah, it's here. So this code generation scheme looks a bit weird. I use a lot of temporary registers here. Can I do the following? Can I just generate the arguments and store them into the global variables? So I generate the value of the first argument, store it in the register r-1 for the first parameter. Do that for all the arguments, and then I compute the value of g, and then I do the rest, and then I call g. So is this correct? And if it's not correct, why is it not correct? Well, you can first say, is it incorrect? Who believes this is correct as well? Okay, good. So what could be wrong? Like, give me an example, give me a code snippet where this translation scheme breaks. Okay, little tip. What do I have? What kind of parameter could I put in here so that this code generation scheme breaks? Let's say I have a function with two arguments, and what code can I put in here so that the code generation scheme breaks?
Couldn't it be that I write the result from E1 into R-1, and then later I overwrite it again because I consume.
Yes. How can I override a global register? The R-1, how can I override that?
With what?
What code do I have to execute to override R-1? I'm not asking you. I can ask you.
Another function?
Yes, so give me a piece of code that I can execute that breaks.
So, for example, G takes two arguments.
Yeah.
First integer I.
Okay. Let's say it takes two. Then, in that case, if nothing else happens, it could be that if I is equal to 7 up here, set to 7, then it might be that the parameter I is set to 2. Because when I evaluate the function called h of 2, it will set the global register r-1 to 2, return, so this happens in here in E2, and then upon return, shortly before calling g, this has overwritten the global value, the value that of the first argument of G, which used to be 7 and now it's 2. Yes?
And can it also be the case that if you have a function called inside function, that you actually, while for the evaluation of one of these parameters, you actually need the old value of the global variable?
But I think you need a function call to actually have another function. I mean, in order to override a global parameter, you need to have a function call.
No,
so
I mean, now you override multiple global variables. And so while evaluating the last global value, couldn't you need for that the already overwritten global variable?
Well, but a later function call can only override the earlier global variable definitions. But you're not calling G unless you have evaluated all the parameters to it. So this calling G is only done here. So it's the other way around, kind of. Like you can, with later arguments, you can kill the earlier arguments. And obviously you can somehow, if functions call each other repeatedly, then you can maybe also have some effect that... Well, not really, because like it's always the locally you could have the can only have locally and within the function call you have can have this effect, I think. But I think, I mean, it doesn't really matter, does it? It's broken, so. Okay, so is this clear that I can seriously have bad code generation schemes?
But why did you move also the G code generation to the end?
I think my intention was not to use any, not n local variables. Because, I mean, if I later do register coloring, I only have a very few registers available, and I might start running out of registers. So I just want to have one register to compile this call. But like,
it so like if in the first case, like the correct case, if you just send all the expressions, when you, I mean, if like expression one is like 10 times the code of G, and I already generated the code of G, then I generate 10 times the expression you want.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure whether I understand exactly what you're saying. But so suppose I take the address of G and put it into I, and then I call I and I say, and I pass it I++, and I increment as a side effect the address of I, then obviously it matters whether I first generate the code for I and store it in RI, or whether I first evaluate the arguments and then call G, which then will then be broken and point to the second instruction of G, presumably. I mean, but this is like undefined C anyway, and also you would never modify a function address directly because it doesn't make sense, it just points to something.
No, I didn't mean the function, I meant the expression E1, E2, E3,
E N. Mm-hmm.
Shouldn't they be before the code generation of G?
Oh. I think not. But on the other hand, I think it could be. Yeah, no, I think you're right. Maybe it could be. I think so. There's the so-called sequence rule in C, which says if you use an identifier in an expression and you modify it, and if you have a second usage of this same identifier, the value is undefined. Because C is free to evaluate in any order, I think. Maybe from left to right, but I think... Is it from left to right?
I don't know. I think we also discussed about that once, and we didn't look into the standard.
Okay, so I would have to look up the standard. If it says from left to right, then you would actually have to... That really means from left to right. First G, then E1 to EN. And it might be free to do whatever, but I think it's from left to right. It rarely makes a difference whether you compute the function first or last. But I mean that it's harder to create stupid examples that do that actually. But I'd have to check. So I'll write that down. Okay, so we have a couple of new instructions that we need to define. So the mark instruction saves two locations. What it does, it looks at inside the machine we have a frame pointer, a special register called the frame pointer, which we'll discuss later when we have local variables, and we have the extreme pointer, which we'll talk about even later when we talk about the heap. So, and mark, all that mark does is it will just put these two registers on top of the stack. That's it. But the intuition of the frame pointer is that it points to the location in the stack where your local variables lie. And this becomes important if you have code like f int x, and this function allocates local memory, a local array. So you could say, I have an int array a, and that has size 2 times x. And so it's not known at compile time how big this array is, but this array is going to live on the stack. So once you enter the function f, and you have to allocate this array, what allocating this array means is just you put 2x cells on top of the stack, and make a set A to the address of the beginning of this region. And then all your local computations happen up here. If you have to store local intermediate results, you push them on top of the stack. But your local variables, they still live down here at the beginning of the, like below the array. So if you have an int b, this local array will be here, and your parameters will be, well, in our case, they're in registers, but in the stack machine, they will live on the stack.
But what if you have two dynamically sized arrays?
Well, it doesn't matter, because you just put them on top of each other.
Yes, but then in order to calculate the address or the stack position of the second array, you have again to use to dynamically add...
Oh, no. Because if you say int b 2 times x, then you'll just put that on top of a and then make b store in b the address that points to the beginning of the array.
Ah, so b is still below both arrays and just contains the address.
So this might be b. Oh, sorry. Oh, yes, now I have b. This was a bad letter. Let's call this thing c. I do have a B already. So this is C and this is B.
And the variant C itself lives right next to B, right? Or below B.
Well, this is B.
And C?
Up here. It's like this blob here, which is...
Yeah, but the address.
It's stored in C. Oh! Yeah, but... Oh, okay, sorry. Yeah, so this is... yeah, I see what you mean. This is A, this is... C, this is B, and you store the value down here. And then you later on you access these variables through the frame pointer. Sorry, yeah. Okay. Then we call a function. How do we call a function? We call a function by saying call RI, which is the register containing the address Q. And what happens is that the current program counter winds up on top of the stack, and that the new program counter is Q and the register is unchanged. So we push one element onto the stack, which is the old program counter. This call also sets the new frame pointer to start at the point to the beginning of the stack frame. So if I allocate anything here, I can reference it using addresses relative to the frame pointer. But we'll come to that. Okay, and the PC is set to the call target. So then if I have a return statement in my function, I need to store this return value. So first I have to compute the return value, and then I store this result in the global register R0, which is the container for our return value. And then there's actually an assembler instruction that does a return. So what does return do? Alternatively, if I return without computing a value, I don't have to set the global register. I just issue return. So just as a side remark, so these global registers are really only for passing arguments. We don't use them inside the function body, which means they are... callee saved? There we go. So... Which means if they're callee saved, that means the function that we're calling has to save them. And the advantage is that at any point we can call another function without worrying to back up the global registers. So as a caller, we can always use the global registers without backing them up. However, as a callee, we have to back up the global registers if we're still interested in using them, before we call another function. So for the local variables, we implement them as callees, caller-safe registers. For global registers, we implement them as callee-safe registers. This is something that you should be aware of and understand, and we probably do in the exercise somehow. Okay, so return is the new statement here, the new assembler statement. What it does, it restores the program counter, most importantly, because it takes the top of the stack, which is that is pointed to by the by the frame pointer, and that is the old program counter. So it looks at the stack at the position of the frame pointer, which contains the old PC, and it sets the new PC to this is the return address, and it sets the PC to the return address, and then it also restores the extreme pointer and the old stack pointer and the stack pointer and the frame pointer, which this kind of frees this whole function frame and the old frame pointer that pointed to the beginning of the function frame of the calling function. Okay, so how do we then translate a whole function? We ignore enter. So function has a certain number of arguments and the declarations and statements. Enter queue has to do with the extreme pointer, with a heap. We don't worry about that. And now we said that the global registers are callee safe. So if somebody calls us, first thing we have to do is we have to back up the global registers into local registers. And we do that with individual moves. So we're not backing up to the stack, we're just backing up to local registers. So the first argument is stored in register L plus 1, and the nth argument is stored in register L plus n. And then we generate code for the statement sequence starting with register L plus n plus 1. L plus n plus 1. Note here that this is not I, this is a 1. So we start with the first temporary register R1, the first local register. And what's the L then? Well, so here we have n parameters, and the L are the local variables that the function declares. So we have L local variables in the function, then in RL plus 1, we store the first parameter, and in RL plus n, we store the nth parameter. These form our L plus n local variables and parameters in the local registers. I'm actually not addressing those in this translation scheme. That is a bit. So additional, like if you had something like printf, which has an open declaration, then there is no possibility to pass these arguments in registers. And so, for instance, on Intel, it's a bit complicated. It just like says, okay, so if the first argument is an integer, you take RAX. If the second argument then is also an integer, you also take RAX, and so on. And then it depends on whether it's a floating point. And so there's a big description of how to pass the function arguments. However, as soon as you declare a function with an ellipsis, like with three dots, that says you can pass an arbitrary number of arguments, everything is passed on the stack in a different way. So having a function with ellipses or with old side, really old Cunningham and Ritchie style declarations where you just don't say anything about what the parameters are and just say, later say what they are, then all the arguments are always passed in on the stack, which is much slower. So printf is already slow because it has an ellipsis in it. Okay, parameters of the function are in R-1 to Rn, R-n. And so this here we have code generation using row prime, and this is basically row, and row contains just global variables. And row prime is extended by adding the declarations for the local variables and the parameters of the function, which map then to R1 to RL and RL plus 1 to RL plus n. And this return, why is this return necessary at all? Because we just saw that early on we had the code generation scheme for return, for the C return and return of an expression. why do we need to issue a return assembler instruction when we translate a function? Yes, that's what return does. But the question is, can we omit it? Because we have this code generation for the return, for the C return statement that issues the return instruction. Sorry, when? I'm using functions. So if I generate code for a function. Then I said earlier, here I said, if I have a return statement, if I find the return statement inside the function, I will just compute the result and issue the return assembler statement. And if there's a return without an argument, I also issue return assembler statement. So my question is, in this code generation scheme for the function translation, why do I have a return assembler statement? Because I'm already generating one for each return instruction in the code. In the C source code. No. Well, I mean, yes, you could say that, but that's a very special thing. Basically, all this, yeah. Yes. So it's very easy. Like, it's very simple. In C, you can write functions without ever mentioning return. And the function just returns naturally. It's not a mistake to omit the return. Sorry? No, that's with a heap. That has to do with a heap, not with a stack. Like, I mean, if we omit the return statement here, it would just continue to the next function and would execute the next function as well, whatever comes after the first function, which probably doesn't make much sense. Okay, so another question. Are the move instructions, are these always necessary? So I said the registers, the global registers in which I pass parameters, arguments, and return values, they are callee saved, which means that the callee has to make backup copies. And the caller doesn't have to worry about overwriting these because it knows they're free, they're not used. And the callee, so inside F here, F has to make sure that it backs up the global registers if it wants to use them again. So when do I not have to move these registers into local registers? Okay, so if F calls another function, then I need to store these. Then I need to make backups into local variables because I will store these on the stack. But if F does not call another function, if it's a leave function, I can actually just use the global variables. And so a function that does not call anything else may just use the global functions, the global registers as normal registers. Because it will never call anything, and only calling can override the global registers. Okay, so now I finish off with the translation of whole programs, which will then explain how to return to the operating system. So assuming that our program P consists of n functions, F1 to Fn, then we also have to assume that there's a single main function. Then we will generate the following code. We will have a little bit of startup code. So if we could translate the, let's call this code P or something, because it's not a statement sequence. So if we translate a program with code P, starting with register one, then what we do is we just need to call main. So we kind of have this abbreviated call sequence, instruction sequence for calling function. We load the constant that is associated with main, called underscore main, into R1. We call mark, which sets up these organizational cells FP and EP. But there's no arguments, at least in our case, in our simplistic setting here. Main doesn't have arguments. Normally it has the command line arguments. So we just call main, in which whose address is in R1. And once it returns, we issue the statement halt, which makes the virtual machine halt and stop, and like that's kind of the return to the operating system. And afterwards, we translate the code for the function F1. And if this is the instruction sequence of the function F1, then we need to extend the address environment with the local declarations of the function F1. So we could assume that the global environment row does not have anything in it, which means we don't have any global variables, and that we explicitly here say how to define the symbol table or the environment for the for translating this the instruction sequence F1 of the first function. And if we have a... Okay, so this plus kind of wants to say, well, how about scoping? This is exactly what the symbol table does. If we declare a local variable inside a function called x, and there's a global variable called x, then we will always take the address for the local variable, so it overrides, it shadows the global variable. So you can, by any means, you can have an integer called main as a local variable, and you can use it inside your function as a local variable, even though there's a main function in your program. Okay, so in the last 3 minutes, I have questionnaires as well. That's a bit too late, isn't it? We wanted to do that in the last. I have the questionnaires as well, but I think we have to do that in the last session anyway. Yeah. Doesn't really make sense now. So I'll quickly go through the stack, the faculty function. So we've seen this function earlier, and there's this enter which just says how many stack cells this function will use. And this has to do, again, with a heap, which we'll do later. We issue enter 5, saying we need 5 stack cells. Then faculty has one argument, which we save. According to the translation scheme of the function, we have to save the global register R1, which is the first argument, into the local variable RL plus 1, and since we don't have any local variable declared, it's the first register. Now we say, now we generate code with I being equal to 2, so we generate code into this register R2. We check if X is less than 0, R2, R3, so we move X, so our row is equal to X maps to 1, because this is the position, this is the value of our, the first argument has been moved to R1, so that's X. So we move to R1 to R2, we compare it, we move the constant 0 to R3, we compare the two, and if that R2 contains 0, then the condition is false, we jump to else, which is up here. Now the then branch, we just return 1, so we load R1 into the register R2, because I is still 2 here in the then branch. We move it to the global register R0, which is the return value, and then we issue return. This code is part of the translation scheme of the if statement, and it's dead, because once we return, the control flow will never reach the jump B statement. Okay. Now, in the else branch, we compute this faculty function, like x times faculty of something. So the most interesting part is down here, where we compute faculty of x minus 1. So we move the address of faculty into R3. We save all the active registers, which so far is only R1 to R2 inclusive. We do mark, we do call, and then once the call returns, we restore these two registers from the stack, so these have to correspond. We remove the result from the faculty call to R3, because here we generated code for register R3. So the result has to be in R3. So this is evaluating faculty of x minus 1. And the remaining bit is executing the return statement, which means we store, we do the multiplication here, this thing, and then we store it in R0. And this return is the leftover of the translation scheme of the if statement. Because we have an explicit return, this erroneous or this extra return is also dead and will never be executed. Okay, are there any questions? Okay. Well, then I see you all next week with heap allocation and pointers and evaluation sheets. So, and also questions. If you have any questions about the exam, we should address those, and maybe we just skip some of the boring parts about arrays. Then you have less for the exam, which is also okay. All right, so then I'll see you next week. Thank you.